Welcome to Digital Yom, a podcast about living a symbolic life in a technological age.
Man cannot stand a meaningless life.
I'm Jason Smith, Jungian analyst and your host for this show. And in this episode, I begin an exploration of the fairy tale, The Iron Stove, and explore what it means to be called beyond the limitations of the ego to an experience of the spirit.
It's the human soul. That's the buried treasure.
Only a life lived in a certain spirit is worth living. It is a remarkable fact that a life lived entirely from the ego is dull, not only for the person himself, but for all concerned. The fullness of life requires more than just an ego. It needs spirit, that is, an independent, overruling complex, for it seems that this alone is capable of giving vital expression to those psychic potentialities that lie beyond the reach of ego consciousness. As I begin to wind down this third season of Digital Yom, I thought I would spend some time taking an in-depth look at one of the fairy tales from the Grimm Brothers collection. My intention over the next several episodes is to let the tale guide us into an exploration of several key elements of the symbolic life and its practice. Now, most of the time in this podcast, I'm only able to bring in a small section of any one story as a symbolic example that highlights the particular theme I happen to be examining at the time. And what I like about being able to stay with one story all the way through is that not only is there the satisfying experience of a kind of aesthetic completeness to it, but even beyond that, it allows for greater attention to some of the details and subtleties within the story that I often have to pass over when I'm looking at just a fragment. In this series, I will be working through a fairy tale called The Iron Stove. And as I usually do in these types of series, I'll be taking the story in sections. This, of course, as I just said, allows me to focus in on the specifics of the story. The disadvantage, however, is that the story gets chopped up and can feel disjointed. It's too easy to lose not only the narrative thread of the tale, but, in a sense, to lose the tale itself. And so to try to mitigate against this problem, I have placed a link to a recording and transcription of the complete story in the show notes, so that you can read and or listen to the full tale in one sitting. In the meantime, let me go ahead and begin the story here, jumping into the first section of The Iron Stove. In the days when wishing was still of some use, a king's son was bewitched by an old witch and shut up in an iron stove in a forest. There he passed many years, and no one could rescue him. Things happen fast in fairy tales. In just two sentences, we are thrown into a whole different world. We're shown the situation that forms the backdrop of the story and becomes the setting in which the central problem will arise that launches the action of the story. And it all begins with that first phrase, "In the days when wishing was still of some use." Now this, we recognize, is a variation on the more familiar "once upon a time," which is a phrase, frankly, that we no longer know how to hear. In fact, it's easy to dismiss these opening phrases as mere conventions, as simply being stereotyped ways of beginning any fairy tale. In many ways, because we tend to hold just this kind of attitude, these phrases have become signals to us that what follows is not something that needs to be taken seriously. "Once upon a time," we believe, leads us into the sweet and sentimental world of childhood. There we might find some things that amuse us, perhaps, with their strangeness or inventiveness, but certainly nothing of consequence, right? Nothing that holds any relevance for our lives. The truth, however, is just the opposite. The opening phrase, whether it's "once upon a time" or "in the days when wishing was still of some use," is meant to direct our attention to the mythic background of existence, alert us to the fact that we are being brought into the presence of archetypal realities, psychological and spiritual truths of the greatest consequence for our lives, whether we know it or not. And of course, so much depends on whether we know it or not. "Only a life lived in a certain spirit is worth living," writes Jung. And this spirit, he suggests, is something beyond just the experience of the ego, what we might call the prosaic perspective that we bring to the business of everyday living. "Only spirit," says Jung, "is capable of giving vital expression to those psychic potentialities that lie beyond the reach of ego consciousness." This difference between the world of ego consciousness and the psychic potentialities expressed by the spirit is imagined by the mythic mind as a difference in the nature of time. To the religious imagination, the human being lives in both historical time and once upon a time. Our contemporary imagination, still steeped as it is in an outworn materialism, has lost all sensibility for the time when wishing was still of some use, leaving us just the relentless march of history. Historical or chronological time is always moving into the future. A mind set to this sense of time, then, will tend to be inclined towards the new and the novel. Archetypal tales involve us in the rhythms of mythic time. They speak of what is enduring and direct us to the past, though not necessarily a literal past. Their history is a sacred history, a recollection of foundational events that occurred, as Mircea Eliade states, in illo tempore, at that time, in a time before time, a time outside of this time, and yet somehow intimately connected with it. They are events, as the Neoplatonic writer Celestius declared, that never happened, but always are. The days when wishing was still of some use then are, in a sense, these days. They are these very times in which we live, if, that is, we are able to recognize them as such, which means to enter into the particular quality of consciousness that is attuned to mythic time. What I call in my book, religious but not religious, experiential consciousness. This is a way of understanding the world not from without, but from within. It's an act of personal participation in the archetypal background of life, an idea expressed very nicely by Emma Jung when she writes, "When a myth is enacted in a ritual performance, or in more general, simpler, and profaner fashion, when a fairy tale is told, the healing factor within it acts on whoever has taken an interest in it and allowed himself to be moved by it in such a way that through this participation, he will be brought into connection with an archetypal form of the situation, and by this means, enabled to put himself into order." Now, there are two points to emphasize here. The first is the idea of putting oneself into order. The healing factor in myths, stories, and rituals is in their ability to connect us to the primordial creative energies that revealed themselves, and, as I am suggesting, continue to reveal themselves in illo tempore, once upon a time. It is this connection that puts our lives in order, or to put it another way, that puts us in harmony with ourselves, with our deepest nature. The second point is that this doesn't just happen, right? It's not enough to simply hear a story or a piece of scripture being read, or to merely go through the steps, the external form of some ritual. Participation is key. One must take an interest and allow oneself to be moved, as Emma Jung says. Some effort of attention and consciousness is required. This, as we'll see in the upcoming episodes of this series, is a central theme in the Iron Stove story. And all of this is complicated by the fact that the certain spirit that we might seek is hidden. In the language of our story, it is locked up in an iron stove in the forest. And this is a variation of an image that I have spoken of before on this podcast, in episode 9 of this third season, titled "The Heart of the Matter," in which I discuss the alchemical image of the prima materia. And so it's an image of the base metal, iron, that needs to be transformed into gold, of the highest value that lies trapped in the lowest place. In the story, this highest value, represented by the king's son, has been bewitched by an old witch, a symbol of the spirit submerged in matter, of a fully human and conscious life still dormant in a merely biological existence, driven by instinct and impulse, of those psychic potentialities of which Jung speaks that lie beyond the reach of ego consciousness. Because the spirit lies hidden, at first we do not even know that there is something missing, something more. Some kind of initiation is needed to make us aware of this something more before we can even begin to engage with it. And this can come in the form of instruction from a mentor or a guide, or probably more often than not, it can come as it does in this story, by getting lost. One day, we look up, or we look out, or we look within, and we find that the old ways no longer work for us, and that somehow, without even noticing, we have wandered into a dark forest. And here we pick up the story. Then a king's daughter came into the forest, who had lost herself and could not find her father's kingdom again. After she had wandered about for 9 days, she at length came to the iron stove. Then a voice came forth from it and asked her, "Whence do you come, and whither are you going?" She answered, "I have lost my father's kingdom and cannot get home again." Then a voice inside the iron stove said, "I will help you to get home again, and that indeed most swiftly, if you will promise to do what I desire of you. I am the son of a far greater king than your father, and I will marry you." Then she was afraid and thought, "Good heavens, what can I do with an iron stove?" But as much as she wished to get home to her father, she promised to do as he desired. But he said, "You shall return here and bring a knife with you and scrape a hole in the iron." Then he gave her a companion who walked near her but did not speak. And in 2 hours, he took her home. Whence do you come, and whither are you going? These questions, addressed to the king's daughter by the prince trapped in the stove, are not inquiries about specific locations in the physical world. Rather, these are questions of the spirit, and they are dangerous questions. For once they have been asked, really asked, that is, by which I mean that they begin to trouble us, to press up on us from within, to sow seeds of doubt about the neat certainties of our lives. Once they have been asked, nothing can ever be the same. And this is the key takeaway here. One day, as if out of nowhere, we might find ourselves wondering, is this all there is? What should I do with my life? What is the meaning of my life? Where do I belong? To ask questions like these is to find yourself lost in a dark wood, not sure whether you should turn back, even if that were possible, or keep moving forward toward who knows what. In the words of the story, the king's daughter has lost herself. And now the question of just what constitutes home has become the central problem to be solved. Whence has she come, and whither is she going? At this point in the story, she imagines, of course, that home means a return to her father's kingdom, a return to the known and familiar. But unbeknownst to her, the known and the familiar are no longer an option. That this is so is shown by that mysterious statement in the tale that the king's son gave her a companion who walked near her, but did not speak, and in 2 hours he took her home. This is a curious image, right? Because after this scene, we never hear about this companion again. So who is he? Or maybe it might be better to ask, what is he? And what I want to suggest here is that this companion is an image of the first faint stirring of that certain spirit that Jung speaks of in the opening quote, and of which he says that it alone makes life worth living. The king's daughter returns to her father's house, but something, it seems, has come with her, has perhaps awakened in her that will make it impossible for her to remain. And it's like that sometimes, isn't it? Sometimes we lose ourselves and cannot find our way home again. Sometimes, without even being aware that it has happened, something has come into us or gone out of us. And we are called away from what has been to what might become. This is an old story. Adam and Eve must leave the safe confines of the garden. The young prince Siddhartha must wander outside the gates of his father's palace, and the princess must wander into the forest and lose track of the way home to her father's kingdom. There is an archetypal demand for the breaking up of all that is too safe, too small, and too well known. As Jung states, the fullness of life requires more than just an ego. It needs spirit. And as necessary as all of this may be, it is still profoundly unsettling. Like the princess in our story, our first response may be to recoil in fear and turn back to seek the comfort of the old way of life. As Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote, people wish to be settled. But, he goes on to note, only as far as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. I'll be back in just a minute with this week's parting words. You'll find a list of all the sources used in this week's episode in the show notes. You'll also find links to connect with me on social media, as well as for my book, Religious But Not Religious, Living a Symbolic Life, available from Chiron Publications. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting the production of this show. You can do so for as little as the cost of a cup of coffee at Buy Me a Coffee. You'll even find some extras for this show posted there from time to time. Just hit the Support the Show link in the show notes. Thank you very much. Now here are this week's parting words. Our story has only just begun. I will continue with the next part of The Iron Stove in the next episode. But for now, I want to leave you with a couple of excerpts from a poem by D.H. Lawrence called Song of a Man Who Has Come Through. This is a poem that speaks to that moment when a new spirit appears and shakes up the old order. It begins with these lines. Not I, not I, but the wind that blows through me. A fine wind is blowing the new direction of time. If only I let it bear me, carry me, if only it carry me. The poet goes on to express his desire to be up to this meeting with the spirit and to the chisel blows with which it tries to break up the hard surface of the old self. He ends with an acknowledgement of the first impulse to keep this spirit shut away from ourselves, but counsels at last a different attitude, a different approach. And here's how the poem puts it. What is the knocking? What is the knocking at the door in the night? It is somebody wants to do us harm. No. No. It is the three strange angels. Admit them. Admit them. Until next time.